Thank you, guys. It's always fascinating to see the different ways that prayer needs are expressed. And sometimes there's not much to be expressed, and then sometimes it's a list. We always know that there's lots of needs and lots of concerns, but I think it's an appropriate reminder for us, even just hearing all the various concerns and needs that are mentioned this morning, and just the illness and lostness, dangers and concerns for health, chronic illness. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And it's certainly timely as we think about our study in Job. I will invite you to turn back there as we continue. Get to my section here. As you guys know, we have spent the last number of weeks in a significant way, because that's what the text does, sort of introducing the entire narrative of this really incredible and extremely unique study. And we've worked our way through these opening verses of really prologue material, where we've been introduced to this incredible man, Job, who was an upright man, a blameless man, an incredibly blessed man, who was also given that same kind of benediction from God himself. When you arrive to that section where there's this divine counsel and the Lord affirms Job's uprightness, his blamelessness, he is recognized as the greatest in all the East. He is a renowned person, a renowned figure. And then we're introduced to this significant and rather unusual scene in which Job's trials, Job's waves of grief are set in motion with this challenge from Satan, the accuser, the adversary, against God and really against his beloved servant, Job, and that the only reason why Job is faithful, the only reason why Job is a true worshiper of God who fears the Lord and turns away from evil is because he's been hedged in by God and he's been so blessed by God. But if you remove all these things, then certainly he will curse you. And so we've seen how Job stood under initially these waves of grief. We talked pretty extensively last week about these waves of grief and the lessons that we can learn from them. But today we're going to move forward in the text, and we're going to pick up in chapter 2, verse 11, where we are introduced to Job's famous friends. Maybe by some accounts or from some vantage points, Job's infamous friends. But I think it's important for us to maintain proper perspective and balance and understand what the text is actually teaching us. These are friends who are not all bad. In other words, they're not riddled with comprehensive insincerity or a lack of true concern for Job. And we'll see that today in quite bold relief. I mean, it's very explicit. When we're first introduced to these initial three friends. And what we're going to see today, and what we're going to kind of talk about today, is this idea, or what kind of emerges out of this larger section, beginning in chapter 2, verse 11, and going all the way through the end of chapter 3, the way I've kind of framed this up, is this principle, or this reality, this experience of when friendship meets despair. As you all know, it can be excruciating for anyone, for us, if we think about ourselves, to have to walk through a protracted season of trial and loss and sadness and grief. It can be excruciating. It can actually seem like waves that just continue to come, and maybe there's some brief moment of reprieve before another wave comes, and we wrestle and we grapple and we despair and we wrestle with even the roots of our own faith and our own convictions. I mean, these are excruciating experiences when we are called upon to walk through them individually. But is it not indeed true? It's also extremely difficult to be a friend and a faithful counselor to the one who is going through such a trial. to the one who is despairing because the circumstances of life and the true trials of life are of a severe and protracted nature that in some ways would elicit that kind of despair. The absence of despair, in other words, would be a little bit unusual because the severity of the trial is so pronounced. So we want to look at this. We want to kind of look at this section from Job because it provides for us, as we know, the Old Testament scriptures provide for us an example that we can follow. It gives us an example. It lifts up off the page illustrative material for us to sort of grab hold of and integrate into our thinking, into our theology, and ultimately into our faithful practice of being a servant and a faithful friend to those who are in great despair. Proverbs 17:17 says, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." A brother is born for adversity. There is a call on a friend to love in such a way that you are recognizing your role in standing in adverse situations and conditions with a true friend. And of course, we know from Paul's instruction in Romans chapter 12 that we are indeed called to rejoice with those who rejoice and in fact to weep with those who weep. That gives us sort of the visual, outward expression of grieving tangibly with those who grieve. So in other words, what Paul is speaking to is not sort of a tip of the hat of sort of benign, not necessarily insincere, but sort of unfeeling concern for someone who's grieving. But the call of the believer, the call of fellow believers in the life of the church, is that when one of us is suffering, we all suffer. When one of us is hurting, we all hurt. That's the nature of the body of Christ. And so Paul says we are called to weep with those who weep in a sincere way. And so we see these elements from these infamous, ultimately, friends in these opening introductory verses where we are introduced to them for the first time. We actually see friendship on display. It's really quite powerful. It's quite pronounced, and it's something that we should, I think, take note of. And then we also see, as we turn the corner into chapter 3, we actually see the depths of Job's despair being expressed. And it is expressed in response to, it's the first response that you see Job have to these friends who come to visit him. It's really a fascinating and, I think, instructive part of the narrative. So when we think about when friendship meets with despair, the first section we're going to look at is this whole idea, this whole recognition of friendship from the text. Let's read verses 11 to 13, and then we'll come back around and pick up chapter 3 as we get to that next section and begin to look at this principle of despair. But in chapter 2, starting in verse 11, you obviously have this divine counsel that is just concluded in chapter 2, where Satan is given permission by God to actually touch Job physically. Remember, in the first divine counsel, Satan is given permission to touch all that he has. And so these waves of grief are consisting of a loss of his possessions, his flocks, his land, and even his family. Just everything that he had and everything that he was given to steward was just sort of taken away from him in one wave after another of loss. And then in the second divine counsel, where Job survived that initial test and did not curse God and acknowledge that it is the Lord who gives and the Lord who takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And naked I was born and naked I will return. And it just his theology remains intact. This next section, Satan is allowed to touch his body. And the scripture tells us here that he was struck with boils, with sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head and back again. And he took a piece of pottery, broken pottery, and was scraping his flesh. So Job, the writer of Job, paints a picture for us of a man who is in a season, a protracted season of excruciating suffering. It would be enough to have to contend with the loss of all your sustenance and all your resources. But then to layer upon that the complete destruction of your dearest family relations, your children, in such a dramatic way, that would be the almost unbearable level of suffering. And then, in the midst of all that grief, you're struck with a physical ailment that is visible. It is a kind of ailment that elicits shame and a certain avoidance by the public. And it is excruciatingly, chronically, incessantly painful. And this is where Job sits. And then we come to verse 11 of chapter 2. It says, "Now when Job's three friends heard all of this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great." Here you have friendship. Friendship encountering despair. The kind of despair, as we've already mentioned, and as the text even gives us clarity about again, despair of a type, a suffering of a type that's hard to even imagine. And so what does this friendship look like? What do we see from this text that would give us maybe some pointers about what we should do or how we should respond or principles that we can employ when we are seeking to come alongside and be a true friend to someone who is at this point of despair, at this point of severe suffering? Well, I think one of the first things that we can observe in this kind of friendship is that it's a kind of friendship that sacrifices personal convenience. This is what you see here. These men actually are inconvenienced in a sense. You have these different locations that are mentioned. The writer is very explicit about naming where they've come from, where they're coming from, their locales. He's not doing that just to give an indication of their city of origin or where their domicile was. It really is to give us a sense that these are men who reside in places that are dispersed away from where Job is residing. And in that day and time, travel of any type, of any meaningful distance, was arduous at best. And so the writer is pointing us to this fact that these men made personal convenience sacrifices because they heard about the suffering, the evil, as the text says. As we've talked about before, this is a Hebrew word that can mean calamity, it can mean great suffering or trial. It doesn't necessarily have to mean evil in the sense that we might think about evil. But it's certainly a form of sort of suffering and evil in the world that he's experiencing at the hand of Satan by the permission of God. And you see these friends going to great lengths to come from their place, their home place, but not only that, to sort of formulate a plan for them to collectively come together. I find it fascinating that this is sort of, these little travel plans are so elucidated in the text. But I think it points to this principle that true friendship, encountering a despairing brother or sister, is willing to be inconvenienced. In fact, it's almost a necessity. Inconvenience or sacrificial perspective on our own schedule or our own list of priorities is an absolute necessity when we're going to come alongside someone who's suffering. And I think that we'll, obviously, you intuitively know that, but we'll see why that is so necessary, even as this text continues. They come from these different places, and there's some scholarly discussion around where these locations are, probably how far away they are. And so I mean, one scholar said 10 to 100 miles away. I mean, I don't know how helpful that is. 10 miles would be a long way in that day and time, in that area. I mean, you have to remember, this is sort of on the edge of the desert. I mean, this is not a friendly climate to be traveling in. And the point is that these are men who were residing in three different locations and came from three different distances and ultimately coordinated their time to go meet with Job. There was a collective concern that had risen up. And in fact, another interesting note about this is that for them to have heard about this gives you an indication of Job's renown. Yes, sir.
Just so people know that out west, if you look at where a town is, a horse could only travel 35 miles a day.
Yeah, so just points to the difficulty of traveling in that kind of climate. They would have been having to seriously plan, seriously set aside time, and really make an extended effort to come and be a friend to Job in his time of most pronounced need. And Job's renown had reached that far. They'd heard about his suffering. They'd heard about the evil that had come upon him. They all come from their various locations, and they come in a coordinated way to show him sympathy and comfort, which is the next principle. Friendship that is compelled to comfort. This is the kind of friendship that is needed, I think, when someone is in a moment of deep, tremendous despair. The objective or the compulsion to sacrifice convenience and to travel a distance or to completely turn your schedule upside down, there is a compulsion on the part of the friend of the sufferer to bring some form of comfort. This was their focus here. Now, obviously, we're going to find out that that's not where their motivation stays. They don't maintain that posture of only being concerned about bringing comfort. And by the way, as we talked about a number of weeks ago when we reviewed the book, The Sin of Empathy, there is a point in which just pure sitting with someone in their grief is no longer what is needed. There is a need for counsel, and there is a need for sort of practical engagement. But nonetheless, there's also a great admonition to us that when we meet and we encounter a brother or sister who is in a deep place of despairing grief and suffering and trial, that we need to be willing to be inconvenienced, and we need to be motivated by a desire to bring some measure of comfort in some way. Our first sort of strategy, our first tactic is not, let me go see if I can fix them, but let me go see if I can bring some kind of comfort. I don't know about you guys, but I struggle greatly with this. I think my natural inclination is, let's go see what we can do to fix all this and sort all this out. If we just sort of move this piece here and that piece there, and we kind of start meditating on this particular verse, or you know, we kind of remind ourselves of this particular theological conviction, I mean, we just got to kind of put the pieces together and all will be well. And ultimately, maybe in some measure that could be true. But what does that say about me and my motivation of friendship when someone is despairing? It says that I'm not motivated first and foremost by bringing comfort. I'm motivated by fixing the situation, which really is more about me than anything else. And so I think it's really a stunning element from this text about these friends, especially if you're familiar with Job, that we see this as their introduction. We're given a picture of good friendship here at the beginning before things sort of go sideways. They're motivated by sympathy and comfort. And then the next thing I think we can observe here is we can observe a kind of friendship that grieves with the grieving. And this just kind of points back to what we've already looked at in Romans chapter 12 of weeping with those who weep. But you see this in the text in verse 12. And when they saw him from a distance, first of all, they did not recognize him. which just gives you another sort of indirect picture of Job's current state. He's not in his fine, you know, linen robe. He's torn and tattered. He's covered in boils that make him physically disformed and unrecognizable. He's frail, probably malnourished, as we'll see in a little bit, as he refers to that himself in chapter 3. So severe is his level of despair and trial that these friends could hardly recognize him. It says they couldn't recognize him from afar. But what did they do? They began to engage in what are the emblems, the symbols of actual grief. This is a normal response. You see this in other places in the Old Testament, but it's also something that was characteristic in that region of the world. That grief of this type is expressed in these outward sort of traditional signs or signals of tearing their own robes. Remember when Job first encountered his initial waves of grief, he shaved his head and tore his robes. Remember that? This is a common practice. And so this is what these men did. They didn't recognize him. It says they raised their voice and wept. So there's the weeping with those who weep. They're engaging in a genuine outward expression of grief because they see this grieving brother, this grieving friend. And then they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. This is just practice of expression of outward grief. This is sort of a call for us, again, as we reference Romans chapter 12, verse 15, that when we are being a friend, a true friend to those who are grieving, that our hearts need to be moved in some way. That it's, in other words, stoicism and full detachment is not the call of the friend in this case. It is okay for us to sort of step into that grief and feel the weight of their hurt and to express that. And I think it's important to note that what Job was able to witness was just that. It was just simply him seeing other people, friends, coming his direction and just giving outward indications that they see the pain that he's in. They, in a sense, are feeling some of that pain along with him. Just giving him that is what we see here. There's a sense in which our grieving with those who grieve compels us to this kind of even outward expression. Now again, some scholars would argue that this was an insincere act, that they were just sort of going through the rote traditional expressions of grief in that time. And you know, there, in some cultures, you can even hire, you know, grievers and wailers to kind of go along with the funeral party, and they're hired people to just sort of stir up the emotion of the event, and kind of their job basically is to mourn and to grieve and to wail. But there are many scholars, and I would agree with those, that say that this is a sincere grief that they're experiencing. I mean, it says their intent, the writer's explicit in stating that their intent is to come and bring comfort and to show sympathy. And then it says that they didn't recognize him, so they're already stunned by what they're seeing. And then toward the end, it even mentions that they saw his suffering was very great. They saw him. They saw him in tremendous despair. And so their response of grief was contingent upon or a response to what they were actually experiencing, what they were actually seeing. This is not a formula. This is not a perfunctory response for them. This is not a tip of the hat to grief. It is actually a brother, a friend, or a group of friends in this case, seeing another brother or sister suffering and grieving and in despair and feeling the weight of that. Obviously, this has to spring from our deepening understanding of who we actually are in Christ. That as the body of Christ, we are knit together in a way that is profound and it is eternal. And I think that in our contemporary culture, that is probably one of the more difficult principles, one of the more difficult truths for us to be preoccupied, appropriately preoccupied with, and then to flesh out on a consistent basis. In a highly mobile society, in a society in which our neighborhoods can be dispersed far apart from one another, in a church sort of environment in which a lot of things that we do are often sort of scheduled gatherings and that kind of thing, like the nature of our contemporary society that are just sort of part and parcel to living in our current time, we have to go sort of an extra distance to remind ourselves of who we are as the body of Christ. When we come together, for example, on our normal gathering times, whether it be on a Sunday morning like this or some other point where community group or another sort of collective gathering, the question I think we should ask ourselves is, are we going to a church thing or are we coming to gather with fellow members of this body? And if we're mindful of that kind of eternal spiritual fellowship that we share by virtue of being adopted by God through Christ into his family, then we are going to spend time with our eternal family. And so, if our family members, if just one of them is experiencing this kind of despair, then we should be compelled to a point of grief as well. If we see it, in some sense, we should also share in it, is the point. Friendship grieves with the grieving. The next thing I would point our attention to is this kind of friendship that is patiently present. Now, I don't struggle with being impatient. That may surprise you. I know that that probably surprises you. And I know that my wife is sitting to my left, so I'm not looking that direction. I'm looking to my right. In fact, I just might as well go ahead and confess, I pretty much struggle with everything I'm talking to you about. This idea of being patiently present, you see this in verse 13, the first part. It says, and they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. Now, I'm sorry, but 7 days and seven nights is a long time. Now, it just so happens it's sort of the traditional mourning period. That's the other kind of reference point from the text. I mean, 7 days and seven nights would be sort of a standard period of mourning or grieving. But I just look at it from my sort of 21st century vantage point. I'm thinking, that I don't have time for that. I mean, that's too long. We got to fix this situation well before 7 days, right? But what this gives us a picture of is it gives us a picture of these friends who were willing to be, maybe by some measure, excruciatingly patient and simply just present in the midst of Job's grief. This is a principle, I think, that we can hold up for ourselves. There is a point at which we might encounter someone, and we might encounter them at a moment or in a period where their grief and their despair is at such a pronounced point, such a pronounced level, that our main objective is for us to just be patient and present with them. And that's it. We're going to grieve with them. We're motivated by a desire to bring comfort. We're willing to sacrifice our own conveniences. And once we get with them, that's enough for the moment. And it might be several moments. It might be days. Days and nights. We are, I think, particularly challenged in our church environment in some ways with this, because we are fortunate and blessed to sort of have a church focus upon the consistent and clear teaching of God's Word. And so most people who are around here for any length of time become pretty grounded in biblical truth and in sound doctrine. And if people that come to our church from other places are drawn to that, and so they gravitate toward that anyway. And so this compulsion that we might feel to express our biblical knowledge, that is sincere because it is objective, transcendent, transformative truth that we're called to meditate on and have our minds renewed in. So I'm not saying there's no place for it. What I'm saying is that there is a place, especially in certain seasons of our meeting with those who are grieving, where just being present is what's needed. That's the priority. And that really ties into the next principle that you see in the second part of verse 13, friendship that is sympathetically silent. So it all ties together. Being present and being silent. This is what it says. They didn't speak a word to him, it says. So they were just present with him for that length of time. So that gives you an indication of a protracted just season of just sitting with someone who's suffering. But then they didn't speak a word. Now, there may have been incidental communication that took place. I mean, this don't need to be too emphatic about the nature of our sympathetic silence. It's not like we go to a grieving friend who's at a point of deep, dark despair in the depths of grief, and they speak to us and we don't speak to them because we're being sympathetically silent. That's the point. I mean, this is about the principle of just recognizing, as the text says, they saw that his suffering was great, and so they didn't speak a word. And I think that this is a principle for us that we can take away from this. Being patiently present and sympathetically silent when we're encountering a depth of despair and suffering, and we want to be a true friend in the midst of that. Francis Anderson in the Tyndale Old Testament commentary sort of describes this principle like this. He says, attention, here in the text, is focused not on the abstract mystery of evil, not on the moral question of undeserved suffering, but on one man's physical existence in bodily pain. There was nothing to be said. These wise men are horrified and speechless. They were true friends, bringing to Job's lonely ash heap the compassion of a silent presence. So I think that there is something for us to glean from this in the ways in which we approach those who are in a place of real pronounced suffering and despair. And in some ways, and at some points, it might be rather counterintuitive for us. It might be rather difficult for us to sustain that kind of patience and to refrain from providing too much sound doctrine infusion in those moments. That time comes, okay? Don't hear me sort of say all we need to do is just sit with people who are hurting and never bring counsel to them. That is not the point. The point is that there is a place for these principles to be employed, these approaches to be employed. That's why this is held up for us as an example. Well, that's a brief picture of the form or the profile of friendship that we see from these men, surprisingly in some ways, when you start working through the rest of the book. But let's look at this profile of despair that we see from Job in chapter 3. Let me read the whole chapter to us. And notice, it says there at the beginning in verse 1, it says, after this, so after 7 days and 7 nights of sympathetic silence, of patient presence, of this motivated desire to bring comfort and sympathy, of this willingness on the part of these friends to travel some meaningful distance and reorient their schedule and their priorities to be with Job during this time. It says, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. So Job, according to the text, does not say, thanks for coming, or it's very meaningful that you would sacrifice your time, or anything of the sort. What we're immediately introduced to is Job's initial open response, if you will, to the presence of these friends who are characterized in the ways I've just described them to you. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Now, this is quite a contrast, is it not, from what we saw from Job after the initial waves of grief hit him, right? Job stood sort of the test of not making God look bad in the face of Satan's challenge. At the end of those two counsels, even rebuking his own wife at her sort of encouragement for him to curse God and die, he's standing firm in sound doctrine and sound theology, and he's verbalizing these things. But then we notice, and what we're seeing here, by the way, what you have to kind of keep in mind here, time's passing, right? I mean, this is someone who is living in and sitting in ongoing pain and grief and suffering. And what we're going to see as we continue to move through this book is that this is not some easy sort of engineer's vision of dealing with suffering. You actually are looking at someone, a man, who is a human being who has sores all over his body and who is still grieving the loss of his precious children that he used to make sacrifices for continually because he was deeply concerned about their spiritual well-being and their standing before God, being the priest of his home. And here we see an indication that grief and despair is taking some hold. Verse 3 says, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest with the kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not hidden as a stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes." This, dear friends, is a man who is in a dark place of despair. A dark place of despair. I'm going to read a brief excerpt, and we're not going to have time to get into this whole section, so we'll pick it up next time. But to kind of set our minds thinking about what Job is experiencing and really what's at stake here, I've been reading C.S. Lewis's book, A Grief Observed, which really it's basically his journal that he wrote. After the death of his wife of 4 years, he had a brief marriage to a woman named Joy that he loved deeply and profoundly. And she succumbed to cancer, And he grieved and grieved deeply, but he recorded his thoughts as he worked through his grief and was published in this book called A Grief Observed. And he's sort of lamenting all the ways that he's kind of grappling with his inner thoughts and the vexation of his mind. And he sort of picks up his thinking and his questioning like this. He says, "Meanwhile, where is God?" This is one of the most disquieting symptoms of grief. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption. If you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you'll be, or so it feels, welcome with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once. And that seeming was as strong as this. What can this mean? Why is he so present a commander in our time of prosperity and so very absent a help in time of trouble? Do you hear the inversion of that psalmist truth? He's in grief, and so his view at the moment is that not God is a very present help in time of trouble, but he says that he's so very absent a help in time of trouble. He goes on, "I tried to put some of these thoughts to a friend this afternoon. He reminded me that the same thing seems to have happened to Christ. Why hast thou forsaken me? I know. Does that make it easier to understand? Not that I am, I think, in much danger of ceasing to believe in God." Listen to what he says. "The real danger is of coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread is not, so there's no God after all, but, so this is what God is really like? Deceive yourself no longer," he says. This is C.S. Lewis giving a window into his own grapplings with his own grief, where despair can compel someone to maybe not abandon their belief in God, but certainly inculcate very wrong thoughts about him. And this is what we're going to see from Job as we take this up next time. Let's close in prayer.